In this sermon, I want to talk about bankruptcy, co-signing, and insurance, and possibly get started into being rich, but I don't know if I'll get that far or not. So let's first of all look at bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is not a scriptural thing. It's a legal thing. It's a legal process by or whereby a debtor can be relieved of some or all of his debts that he owes to a creditor, but it's not a biblical thing. I think a man named Joey Adams put it pretty well when he said, "Bankruptcy is a legal proceeding in which you put your money in your pants pocket and give your coat to your creditors." A lot of people make out pretty well in bankruptcy and are able to just get off the hook, and then the creditors are left holding the bag. But I guess, then again, the creditors were probably stupid for loaning somebody like that money anyway. But it's not a biblical position. It's not scriptural. The concept of having a court order, a judge order, that'll make the sentence sound more correct. The concept of having a judge order a creditor to forgive a debt is not biblical. I was talking about a court doing the ordering. I wasn't talking about a court order as a thing, but the court ordering. But anyway, in case that was confusing. See, the Bible teaches that it's up to the mercy of the creditor, that is the person who made the loan, it's up to him as to whether he will forgive a debt or not. It's not up to the debtor to decide if he's going to pay, or it's not up to a judge to decide if the debtor's going to pay. It's up to the creditor, the loaner, to determine if he's going to make the credit or make the debtor pay or not. Let me give you an example here in Matthew 18:26-27. Matthew 18:26-27 says, "The servant therefore fell down and worshipped him, saying, 'Lord, have patience with me, and I will pay thee all.' Then the Lord of that servant was moved with compassion and loosed him and forgave him the debt." And as we read this passage this morning, this man owed a huge sum of money and he couldn't pay, and the creditor ordered that the man would be sold to pay the debt, him and his wife, his children, everything that he had, and he would be an indentured servant, basically, until he paid the debt. But he asked for mercy, and the creditor had mercy on him, forgave him all the debt. That's the creditor's prerogative. Turn with me to Luke 7:41-42. Luke 7:41-42. Jesus here teaches a parable to a man that was upset that Jesus was allowing this woman who was a sinner to wash his feet with her tears, and he didn't like the fact that Jesus was having anything to do with this woman. And he says, "There was a certain creditor which had two debtors, the one owed 500 pence and the other 50. And when they had nothing to pay, he frankly forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him most?" He frankly, which means he freely, forgave them both. He didn't have to do that, but he did it out of mercy. But Jesus didn't notice his parable didn't say, you know, there were these two debtors and neither of them can pay. So they went to the judge and they said, "Hey, we don't want to pay." And the judge says, "Okay, don't worry about it. We'll just let you declare bankruptcy and, you know, screw the creditor." That's not how things worked in the Bible. It's not how things should work today either. In the Bible, there was actually the concept of a debtor's prison. Let me give you a few verses, a few examples of this. Leviticus 25:39. Because you know what it is, right? If you borrow money from somebody and you don't pay it back, there's a word for that. You know what that word is? Theft. That's what it's called. It's called theft. And when you steal something from somebody, you break the law and you go to jail, right? So if you just walked up to a bank and put a gun in somebody's face and said, "Give me $10,000," and you take the $10,000, you go to jail for that, right? But if you go up to the bank and say, "Give me $10,000, sign on the line, and then don't pay it back," and then go to a judge and he says you can declare bankruptcy and not pay it back, everything's cool. What's the difference? You took $10,000 that wasn't yours and didn't give it back in both cases. One's legal and one's not. Leviticus 25 and verse 39. Leviticus 25 and verse 39. And if thy brother that dwelleth by thee be waxen poor, and be sold unto thee, thou shalt not compel him to serve as a bondservant, but as a hired servant. And then he goes on. But all the point there that I wanted was, he's waxen poor, and he's sold unto thee. Now, the implication is that he probably had debt that he couldn't pay, or he just couldn't afford to live, and then he sold himself as a bondservant to live. Either way, in both cases, you could become a slave if you didn't have, if you weren't able to pay your debts, or if you were just poor and that was your only option. Let me give you another example in 1 Kings 4 and verse 1. Now, the Lord in no way here was condemning the idea of somebody that's poor and in debt being sold to pay for his debts. Not at all. 2 Kings 4 and verse 1. Now there cried a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets unto Elisha, saying, Thy servant, my husband, is dead. And thou knowest that thy servant did fear the Lord. And the creditor is come to take unto him my sons to be bondmen. Very similar to what Jesus said in Matthew 18, right? Couldn't pay. Her, in this case, her sons were going to be sold as bondmen. Now, Elijah's answer was not, well, just go to the judge and declare bankruptcy. That's all. Screw the creditor. That's not what he said at all, but I'm not going to get into the rest of that. But the point is here that this is how it worked back then. Now, it is not stated, but obviously the husband was in debt. That's what a creditor is somebody that loans you money, right? The husband's in debt. He can't pay his debt when he dies, and he leaves his wife with a big debt that she can't pay. And guess what? The children get sold to pay the debt as bondmen. That's how it used to work. That may sound harsh or unfair to you, but that's only because we live in a debtor society and we take the side of debtors. We don't take the side of creditors, right? Yeah, it is harsh, but life is harsh, right? And not paying your debts is harsh. And God doesn't take that lightly. Now let's turn back over to Matthew 18, 23 through 25. Matthew 18, 23 through 25. This is just prior to the verse we just read here a minute ago. Therefore is the kingdom of heaven likened unto a certain king which would take account of his servants. And when he had begun to reckon, one was brought unto him which owed him 10,000 talents. But for as much as he had not to pay, his Lord commanded him to be sold, and his wife and children and all that he had, and payment to be made. Now, the point of Jesus teaching this parable is to teach us to forgive. This was spoken on the heels of Peter asking if his brother sinned against him seven times, should he, how many times should he forgive him? Seven times. And he said, not seven, but 70 times seven. Right? So I'm not saying that we ought not to forgive people that owe us money. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the Bible does allow for a creditor, if he doesn't want to forgive it, then if the man can't pay the debt, then he works it off. He becomes a indentured servant or goes to debtor's prison or whatever. The Bible does allow for that, but of course mercy rejoiceth against judgment. So I'm not telling you, far from it, that if somebody owes you money, you push it to the limit and you make sure he pays no matter what, and you go after his everything he has and his wife and kids. No. Forgive the debt and don't be dumb and loan people money again, right? I'm not saying that we should be harsh and not forgive debt. I'm just saying that the Bible does not teach this idea of bankruptcy, where you run up debt and then you just get off scot-free. The Bible does not teach that at all. Verses 28 through 30. But the same servant went out. This is him after he was forgiven. The same servant went out and found one of his fellow servants, which owed him 100 pence. And he laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, Pay me that thou owest. And his fellow servant fell down at his feet and besought him, saying, Have patience with me, and I will pay thee all. And he would not, but went and cast him into prison till he should pay the debt. Debtor's prison. And this may sound like something from ancient history, thousands of years ago in the Bible. It's not. Debtor's prison has been around, well, was around up until fairly recently in history, really. It's interesting here that I just noticed something this morning there in verse 25, when he commanded that he and his wife and children would be sold and payment to be made, it could be that the man is sold to somebody else, to another man, to buy him as a slave, and then that other man pays the creditor what was due. Right? It could be that you could sell yourself to the creditor to be his slave, or it seems like in this case, you would be sold, and then the payment would be made. Some other man bought you, and then he pays the creditor, and then you work off the debt that you owe the man that bought you now, basically, is what it kind of sounds like there. But anyway, regardless, it all works the same way. But like I said, debtor's prison is not some ancient, you know, custom that only goes back to Bible times. There were debtor's prisons in America until the mid-1800s. Where people who could not pay their debts would be incarcerated until they worked off the debt that they owed. That's really not that long ago. That was, you know, my great-great-grandfather came over here to the U.S. at that time, mid-1800s. It's not that long ago, right? So things have just changed a lot, that's all. And our ideas have changed a lot about things. But if we still had a debtor's prison today, people would be much more careful about taking on debt and how much debt they took on. People wouldn't be taking on these massive debts and running up all these credit cards and the tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars in student loans and all that kind of stuff. People wouldn't be doing anything like that if they knew that if something happens to me and I lose my job and I can't pay, I'm going to jail, right? That would be quite a deterrent to this debt-laden society that we live in. All right, now let's move on to another topic. And that is co-signing. The Bible refers to this as being surety. This is, if I had to rank, you know, things in order of the dumbest thing you could possibly do in your life, this would be close to the top. I mean, it's not the dumbest thing. You know, people have done dumber. But this is a really dumb one. So if you really want to do something stupid and screw up your life, this is a great way to start here. Co-signing. Let me define the word the Bible uses, and that is surety. Surety is means of being sure. A formal engagement entered into, a pledge, bond, guarantee, or security given for the fulfillment of an undertaking. A person who undertakes some specific responsibility on behalf of another who remains primarily liable. One who makes himself liable for the debt or miscarriage of another, or for the performance of some act on his part, for example, payment of a debt, appearance in court for trial, etc. And surety is also a bail or a security. So a man that is surety for a friend, he puts himself under a legal obligation to guarantee the payment of the debt or the other obligation, whatever it might be. Like I said, this is called co-signing today, another term for being surety. And a man who is surety for another assumes the blame if the obligation is not fulfilled. And I'll give you an example from back in the book of Genesis in chapter 43. Genesis 43 and verse 9. You probably remember the story of Joseph when he was sold into slavery by his brethren, and then he eventually becomes prime minister of Egypt, and then there's a famine in the land. Jacob sends his sons to Egypt to get corn. They meet Joseph, but they don't realize it's their brother. And then he asks them, do you have any other brethren? And they said, yes, they had one other younger brother. Of course, Joseph knows all this. Joseph was wanting to see his youngest brother, his youngest and only full brother, Benjamin. And so he told them, don't come back. If you come back again without your brother, you're not going to see me. So don't come back without your brother. You ever come back again, you bring your younger brother. I want to see him. Well, when they go back to Israel, and then eventually they run out of food again, and Jacob tells them to go back to Egypt to get more food, Judah, the oldest brother, tells Jacob that the man in Egypt told us, if we don't bring our younger brother back, don't bother, because we're not going to see his face. And Judah didn't want to send Benjamin with him, and so, Jacob, there we go. Like my dad, when I talk to my dad and he's trying to say my brother's name, he's like, Chad, Carl, Mark, Brett. He names off everybody in the family before he can think of the right one. Anyway, what's his name? Jacob. Jacob doesn't want to send Benjamin, and Judah says, essentially, I'll be surety for him. You know, my butt's going to be on the line here. If anything happens to him, I'm going to be the one that's taking responsibility. Genesis 43 and verse 9. I will be surety for him. This is Judah speaking. Of my hand shalt thou require him. If I bring him not unto thee and set him before thee, then let me bear the blame forever. That's what it is to be surety. So when you sign as a cosigner on a loan, you are going to take the blame forever until that debt is paid. It's not like the bank. It's not like when you give a reference on a resume, and once in a while they call the reference, they may use it, they may not. When you sign and you're a co-signer, they are coming after you, period. It's going to happen. That person doesn't pay, they're going to be after you, they're going to be suing you, pursuing you with legal means. You are on the hook for that thing, just as if you took out the debt yourself. And the Bible warns us of the danger of being surety for another's debt. Let's look at Proverbs 6, 1 through 5. Proverbs 6, 1 through 5. You may remember in the series on Proverbs, when we went through these verses, I talked a lot about being surety. Proverbs 6, 1 through 5. Solomon writes here, my son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger. You see, you've got three involved here. You've got his son striking hands or shaking hands with a stranger for his friend. So his friend wants to take out a loan or needs money. His friend is not credit worthy. So you, being the dolt that you are, shake hands with a stranger and says, hey, don't worry about it. If he can't pay, I'll be on the hook for it. Okay? Thou art snared with the words of thy mouth. Thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. You just jumped into a trap when you co-signed for somebody. Do this now, my son, and deliver thyself when thou art come into the hand of thy friend. Go, humble thyself, and make sure thy friend. So you do whatever you can to get out of this situation. Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. And as I talked about in that, when I went through this in the Proverbs series, do whatever you can to get out of the situation. Now, you can't just unsign when you're co-signed. But what you can do is talk to your friend and tell him and encourage him, you know, make sure you pay this debt off and make it all about the friend. Don't make it about you. Say, you know, if you don't pay this debt, your credit's going to be destroyed. You're going to be in trouble. You know, who knows what else? You're going to have a hard time, you know, buying a house someday or whatever. You know, give him all the reasons why it's advantageous for him to pay off this debt, when really what you really want him to do is pay off the debt so that you are not on the hook for it. And I talked about that in that series, and I refer you to that for a lot more detail. Now, the Bible teaches, these are basically God's words, not mine, a stupid person strikes hands and becomes surety in the presence of his friend. Proverbs 17 and verse 18. Proverbs 17 and verse 18. A man void of understanding. Now that's just a nice way of saying somebody that's stupid, void, empty of understanding, right? A stupid person, in other words, strikes hands and becomes surety in the presence of his friend. You know what God is telling you? If you co-sign for a loan, you are stupid. He's telling you that. If you co-sign for a loan, you're stupid. So don't do it. Ever. For anybody. Under any circumstances, no matter what, never, ever co-sign. Because it's a stupid thing to to do, and chances are it will turn out badly for you and cause you great damage. Now, in this verse that we just looked at, his friend is present when he does it, which implies that he's striking hands with a third party for the benefit of his friend, right? If you strike your hand in the presence of your friend, right, there's the third party that we looked at in Proverbs 6, right? You strike your hand with a stranger for the benefit of your friend. Now, a man that becomes surety for his friend is stupid, void of understanding. We just looked at that, right? And here's the reason why somebody that's surety for a friend is stupid. Because, first of all, it's a good way to go broke if something happens and your friend can't pay. Let's look at Proverbs 22, 26 through 27. I mean, it's bad enough to take on debt for yourself and not be able to pay and go broke because of it. It's really bad if you sign for somebody else. You didn't even get to enjoy whatever he took out the loan for. You didn't get to enjoy the car that he just bought, he didn't buy it, but he took out a loan for. You didn't get to enjoy the house that he just took out a mortgage for. You didn't get to enjoy the furniture or whatever. Whatever he just took out the loan for, you didn't get to enjoy any of that. All you get is screwed in the end, right? That's really bad. That's doubly bad. Proverbs 22, verses 26 through 27. Be not thou one of them that strike hands or of them that are sureties for debts. If thou hast nothing to pay, why should he take away thy bed from under thee? See what happens? If your friend has nothing to pay, the bank comes to you. And if you have nothing to pay, then guess what? They take away your bed from under you. They take everything that you have just as if it was your debt. Right? They'll do whatever they have to get their money back. Very, very bad idea. And see, the thing is, you could say your friend can't get a mortgage, or your friend can't get a car loan, or your daughter, son, father, mother, whoever, brother, sister, somebody can't get a loan for something that they need. And you, things are going well for me right now. I've got a great job. I could pick up that payment if I had to, and you co-sign. And then a year from now, your family member loses his or her job, or he's just a total dirtbag and bum and doesn't pay the debt, and the debt bank comes back to you. Well, guess what? A month ago, you just lost your job, and now the bank wants their money. And what are you going to do? You can't pay it. And then what are they going to do? Take away your bed from under you. They're going to take everything that you have to satisfy that debt. It's also a good way to lose a friend if you can't pay. See, if you co-sign for a friend, he's probably not going to be a friend for too long. Because I'll mention this a little bit later, but you know the reason why the bank requires him to have a co-signer? It's because he's not creditworthy. It's because the bank thinks that he will not pay, or they think there's a high likelihood he will not pay. So if you co-sign for somebody, plan on him not paying, because the bank is planning on him not paying. And the bank probably knows a little bit more about loaning money than you do. It's also a good way to get sued or killed if you don't have the money to pay your friend's debt if he defaults. It just depends what kind of a bankster you're dealing with. If you're dealing with a bankster, you're going to get sued. If you're dealing with a gangster, you're going to get killed. Now, if a man that becomes surety for a friend is stupid, then a man who becomes surety for a stranger is exceedingly stupid. See, a friend will be more likely to pay his debt so that you're not left on the hook for it, right? Because he might, you know, value your friendship, or at least maybe he's some man of character, and so he's going to do whatever he can to pay that debt, hopefully. But a stranger has little to no incentive to pay because he doesn't know you and he's never going to deal with you again. Now you think, well, who in their right mind would co-sign for somebody they don't know? Well, apparently people do this. I don't think I actually know anybody personally who has done it, but it happens because Solomon warned us about it. And if it didn't happen, he wouldn't warn us about it. Proverbs 11 and verse 15. Proverbs 11 and verse 15. It says, he that is surety for a stranger shall smart for it. and he that hateth suretyship is sure. You want to be sure? You want to be on a good foundation? Hate co-signing. That's a good first step to being sure. But the first part of that verse, he that is surety for a stranger shall smart for it. In other words, you're going to be hurt if you are co-signing for somebody you don't know or don't know very well. You know, if some friend of yours say, hey, my son really needs a car. He can't get to work. I can't co-sign for him. Will you please co-sign for him? You're co-signing for a stranger. You don't really know this kid, right? You're going to smart for that. Guaranteed. Smart means, when you're talking of wounds, etc., it means to be a source of sharp pain, to be acutely painful. So you are going to suffer pain if you co-sign, especially for somebody you don't know. Now, if a man is stupid enough to be surety for a stranger, now this would be if you're on the other end of this transaction, you better take some collateral from him to hedge against the likelihood that neither he nor the stranger will be able to pay. So if you happen to be the one making the loan, and the guy that wants to borrow money from you, you deem to be uncreditworthy, which why in the world he would loan him money anyway, I don't know. But if you decide, okay, I'll only loan you this money if you get somebody else to co-sign that they will promise to pay me back if you can't. Like I said, if being a co-signer is dumb, being the one that is loaning the money to somebody who needs a co-signer is dumber yet. I mean, you are at the pinnacle of dumbness if you're doing this. So never, ever, ever do it. It'd be the stupidest thing in the world. But if you do want to take that road down, that road to dumbness, make sure you take a hedge, a collateral. Proverbs 20 and verse 16. Proverbs 20:16, take his garment that is surety for a stranger and take a pledge of him for a strange woman. So you better take something that will at least help to mitigate the damage if you don't get paid back. But then again, if you're dealing with somebody who is uncreditworthy and broke, what do you suppose he's going to have to give you for collateral for this loan? Probably nothing. So just, again, just a bad idea. Don't do it. Like I mentioned earlier from Proverbs 15 or 11:15, he that hateth suretyship is sure, it says. And sure means free from or not exposed to danger or risk, not liable to be injured or destroyed, safe. So you're safe. If you hate suretyship, if you hate co-signing, and you will never co-sign under any circumstances, you've just mitigated your danger and risk. You're safe, at least in that context anyway. So the Bible's telling us it's always a safe bet to not be the guarantor of someone else's debt. It's always a safe bet. Now, they might not be happy with you, but you know what? Who cares? Who cares? If your family member really, really needs this, whatever this thing is that he's got to take out a loan for, and you are the only thing standing in between him and having that thing because you won't co-sign, he's mad at you, tough. Because you're not the one standing in the way of it. You know what's standing in the way of it? His bank account is standing in the way of it. His personal finance habits are standing in the way of it. It's not you. Don't ever let anybody guilt you into being a co-signer and make them think that it's just all your fault. I would be better off. I would be fine if you would just co-sign because then I'd have a car. Then I could get to my job or whatever, right? Don't ever let somebody guilt you into that. It's not your fault. It's his fault. It is his fault, period. Nobody else's. Now, I've already pretty much said this, but let me just go over it again. You should never co-sign for somebody, for someone else, for anything, even if he's family. A person should not be going into debt for anything, with the possible exception of buying his first house. I've been over this many times in this series. And even borrowing money for that should be avoided if possible. But nobody should be going into debt for anything beside their first house, right? So that's rule number one right there. So all other things, as I've already said multiple times in this series, all other things, including cars and trucks and home maintenance and home upgrades and appliances and tools and equipment and tractors and furniture and four-wheelers and motorcycles and boats and other toys and education, college, everything, you name it, anything outside your first house, everything else should be paid for in cash, period, right? And if the person doesn't have the cash to pay for something, he can't afford it, and he shouldn't buy it. Well, I can't get a house if I don't get a cosigner. Well, then you don't get a house. Big deal. You rent, right? Lots of people do it. I can't get a new car unless somebody cosigns. Well, don't get a new car. Drive your old junker. Big deal. And you can buy an old clunker for next to nothing. And if you had to, you know what? You make it work. You somehow get to work. You borrow somebody else's car, you get a ride, whatever you have to do to get to work for a few weeks to save up enough money for the biggest piece of crap you can find, and then you go to work for another few months, and then you buy another, a little bit better piece of crap, and you work your way up, and before you know it, you know, you're going to be driving something half decent. I've already been over all that. Don't co-sign for them. Makes no sense to co-sign on a loan for something that somebody doesn't need. Now, if a man wants to finance a house or a business startup, the bank will determine if he's creditworthy. And if he's not creditworthy and they will not give him a loan, then you would be a fool to co-sign for him, right? I mean, think about this. The bank looks at his credit history and says, oh, he doesn't pay his bills. He's defaulted on his credit card loans. His student loans are years behind, right? This guy's a bum. I'm not giving him a loan unless you co-sign for it. Well, why would you co-sign for a guy like that? There's a reason why a guy needs a co-signer. It's because he doesn't have, either he has bad credit or no credit. And if he's got no credit, he doesn't need to be taking out any loan for anything, period, except for a house. And I've already told you how to do that. If you've got no credit, if you have 2 years of renting history, if you have 2 years of a steady job, if you've paid all your bills on time, you can go to a bank that does manual underwriting and they will give you a loan without a credit score. Right? So there's no reason ever, you know, that you'd need to co-sign for anybody. Either he's uncredit worthy and you'd be stupid to co-sign for him, or if he has no credit at all, there are ways to go about it. He's just going to have to spend a couple of years working on it, paying his rent on time, being in a steady job for a couple of years. So there's ways to get around that. You do not need to co-sign ever for anybody for any reason. Now, if the bank's dumb enough to give him a loan, but he can't afford the down payment, you would be a fool to loan it to him. If somebody can't afford a down payment on a house and the bank won't loan him money unless he has a down payment, don't loan him the down payment. If he hasn't saved money for a down payment, he either doesn't make enough money to save anything, which is probably unlikely. What is more likely is he can't manage his money. He has not saved any money. He hasn't saved 20, let alone 20. I mean, banks will take a lot less than 20% these days. He can't save 5% of the price of a house. Why in the world would you loan him the money for it? This guy needs to learn how to manage his money. And I knew of a situation where this happened. Guy was buying a house, did not have a down payment saved, and a family member loaned him money for the down payment to buy the house. Don't ever do that. Really, really dumb. Really, really dumb. That's a good way to lose a relationship and money at the same time. I wouldn't even give him the money for a down payment. You haven't taught him a thing. The guy hasn't saved a penny in his entire life, obviously. If you got no down payment for a house, you've never saved a penny. Why would you give somebody money who has not shown 1 ounce of maturity and can't save any money? You are not helping that person. That's what I think anyway. Now, maybe if your child had saved up 10% for a down payment and he needed a little bit more and you've seen that he's done well and worked hard and saved money and blah, 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 you know, then you wanted to help him with the rest of it, you know, that would be your prerogative. But somebody that has no money saved for a down payment, I wouldn't help. Not me. Actually, I would help. I'd help him by not helping him. That's what I'd do. I'd help him the most by not helping him. As I mentioned before, the reason a person needs a cosigner is because the bank does not think he will repay the loan. So why in the world would you put yourself on the hook for a man's debt whom the bank thinks will not repay? It's crazy. Crazy, crazy. So like I've already said this, if you cosign for a loan for someone, if he cannot or will not pay for any reason, the bank will come after you for the payments. And I listen to the Ramsey Show regularly, and I've heard plenty of callers call in with this same thing. I cosigned for my family member for a house, and now either they're not paying or I went out of this situation and I can't get out of this situation, or people go together and buy a house together that aren't married, or family members, you know, buying a house together, parents and children. Don't do any of that thing. That is crazy. Do not get involved in any financial transaction, any financial contract with anybody that's not your spouse. Period. Ever. Don't ever do that. Really, really bad idea. It's not going to end well. So, avoid co-signing like the plague. That's the moral of the story here. And if you have done this stupid deed, then go listen to the sermons on Proverbs 6:1-5 to learn some tactics on how you can try to extricate yourself from that situation. All right, now let's move on to insurance. Now, co-signing is one of the dumbest things you can ever do. Having the right insurance is probably one of the smartest things you can ever do. Now, there are some insurances that you should have, some that you should not have. But this is a very important part of being financially responsible, is having proper insurance. Insurance is risk mitigation. That's really what it is. When you buy an insurance policy, you're transferring the risk from yourself to the insurance provider, right? You're giving them the risk. And that's why you pay money to transfer the risk. That's what the premium's all about. Now, some people just like to bury their head in the sand and just think, oh, you know, I'm not worried about it. I don't need insurance. I don't need health insurance. I don't need car insurance. I don't need homeowners insurance because the Lord will take care of me. You know, the Lord will take care of me. Do you know that bad things sometimes happen to good people? You ever heard that? Have you ever heard of a guy named Job in the Bible? Job was a good man, didn't do anything wrong. And yet very, very bad things happened to Job. I don't know if Job had an insurance policy on all those camels and asses and, you know, all that stuff or not. Probably didn't have that kind of thing back then. But it wouldn't have been a bad thing if he did, because he lost everything. Everything. How about John the Baptist? Did absolutely nothing wrong, ends up having his head cut off. You know, don't just think, I am doing the best that I can to be a good and godly Christian, to fear God, to obey Him, to keep His commandments. I'm doing everything that I can to be the best Christian that I can be. Therefore, God is not going to let anything calamitous happen to me. You're wrong. You're wrong. Yeah, John the Baptist got his head whacked off for doing the right thing, not doing the wrong thing. Remember the Apostle Paul? Beaten, shipwrecked, all the stuff that he went through, right? He didn't do anything wrong. And if none of those ones convinced you, have you ever heard of the person called the Lord Jesus Christ? Did nothing wrong, got crucified for it, right? Bad things happen to good people sometimes. It happens. And in a world where families and communities don't take care of their own, insurance becomes a necessity. You see, if we were Amish and we lived in an Amish community, then I'd say, yeah, insurance is unnecessary. It really is. And I grew up just miles from an Amish community. And you know what happens in an Amish community if somebody's barn or somebody's house burns down? The whole community comes together, and literally in like a day, that thing is built back up. It's there. I've seen them raise a barn. And I'm not talking about like a little, you know, city barn, which is like a little shed in the backyard. I'm talking like a barn, like 80 by 80 by two stories high, like a massive barn built in a day. I've seen it done. That's different, though. We don't live in those communities. Good luck. You think your house burns down and your neighbors are going to come over and do anything but maybe bring you a fire extinguisher if you're lucky, right? You think your neighbor's going to do anything? I mean, maybe bring you a meal or something when you're homeless. Are they going to all band together and rebuild you a house? You got to be kidding me. ain't going to happen. I mean, not that I'm aware of, anyway. So insurance is a necessity when you live in a modern society like we do, and we don't do like people used to, and families and communities take care of each other. The early death of a husband without life insurance could mean poverty and desperation for a wife, even or especially one with young children. Any man who is a father with young children in the house is absolutely irresponsible if he does not have life insurance. That is a fact. Irresponsible. This stuff is dirt cheap. It costs you next to nothing to have. I'm talking term life. I'm not talking whole life. I'll talk about that in a second. That stuff's a huge waste of money. Term life. If you're a husband and you're the provider and you die and you have no life insurance, your wife and children are destitute. Like, they're going to starve, or maybe not starve, but they're going to have a very hard life ahead of them. Very, very hard life. It is absolutely irresponsible. You remember the passage in 2 Kings 4 and verse 1? Remember the wife, the lady said that my husband died and now the creditor's coming to take my sons to be bondmen? Yeah, that's what happens. Without home insurance, a house fire or a tornado could mean great financial hardship. Without health insurance, one accident or one disease could easily bankrupt you. That's the number one cause of bankruptcy today, is medical things. Huge medical bills. I hate health insurance. I don't have health insurance. I have something better. I have Christian Healthcare Ministries. I absolutely loathe health insurance. I loathe the whole medical establishment, to be quite honest with you. It's an unbelievably expensive, horrible, horrible system. They are great if you have, like, trauma. You get in a car wreck, they do a good job. But the rest of that stuff, it's terrible. It's very, very expensive. But anyway, either have health insurance or have something better like Christian Healthcare Ministries, because one accident, one illness, and you are bankrupt. You are bankrupt, chances are, unless you're very wealthy. So prudent people will foresee the evil and hide themselves from it. Proverbs 22 and verse 3. Proverbs 22 and verse 3. A prudent man foreseeth the evil, like the evil of your house burning down or getting blown away in a tornado. You know, I know those things aren't likely, but they're certainly possible, and they happen to people, I mean, all the time, right? How many house fires have I read about in this town in the last year? 4 or 5, probably? Easily, right? It happens. I mean, it's not likely, but it happens. A prudent man foresees the evil and hides himself. A prudent man foresees the evil that he might wreck his car and destroy it and lose the car, and more importantly, hurt or kill somebody else and be on the hook for massive, massive money. A prudent man foresees the evil that he might die early. I mean, it happens, especially if you took the COVID shot. You got a really good chance of that. A prudent man foresees that evil and gets a life insurance policy. He hides himself. But the simple pass on and are punished. The simple says, it's not going to happen to me. Well, maybe it won't. But what if it does? What if it does? So here are some types of insurance that you should have. First one is life insurance, but not just any life insurance. Now, I say you should have, I'm talking to younger people. If you're older, forget about it. It's way too expensive, makes no sense whatsoever if you're in your 70s to buy life insurance. Who's going to sell life insurance to somebody in their 70s? I mean, they're going to charge you an absolute fortune for it. You know why? Because, like, you're one breath away from death. Like, literally. If you're in your 70s, you are what the Bible calls very old. Your days are fulfilled. You're on borrowed time if you're past 70. That's just a fact, right? So life insurance companies are not going to sell insurance at any reasonable price to anybody in their 70s. So I'm not talking to people in their 70s or even 60s. That ship has sailed. You shouldn't need it when you're that age. And if you do need it, well, tough, because you're not going to get it. It's too expensive. I'm talking to people, though, who are below that age. So below probably age 60, 65, maybe below 60, something in there anyway. So, but you don't want just any insurance. You don't want anything except for term life. You don't want whole life. You don't want universal life. You don't want any of these crazy policies that are life insurance bundled up with an investment. Bad idea. You get bad insurance and you get a bad investment and you pay a fortune for it. Bad idea. Keep those things separate. You want term life insurance. Anything else is a waste of money. See, like I said, whole life is named that because you pay your whole life. You just keep paying, right? You pay and pay and pay and pay until the end of your life. And you pay a fortune for it. I should have looked up the figures, but for instance, like somebody in their 30s can buy a $500,000 term life policy for $20-some a month, $30-some a month at the most. Somebody the same age wants to buy a whole life policy, $500,000. I mean, you'd be paying crazy, like thousands, I don't know, $1,000 or more. You'd be paying a huge amount of money for it. But a term life, like I said, is dirt cheap. And the whole life, yes, it builds cash value and all that. It's still a bad investment. It's not, the insurance company is selling you that for a reason because they make money on it. It's not a good investment. Get cheap term life. Get a cheap term life policy. I'll give you more information on that below. And invest the money that you would have put into the whole life policy. So, for instance, and I'm just making up numbers, if you could buy term life for $25 a month, or you could buy the same coverage in whole life for $1,000 a month, buy the term and then invest the $975 a month into mutual funds, and you're going to be a millionaire by the time you retire, and you know you won't need the life insurance by the time you die. Right? That's the whole point of term life. It's for a term, 20 years, 30 years, whatever. It's generally for the term when you have other people that are relying on you. So in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, when you have a wife and especially children relying on you and your income, and you probably have a mortgage at that time, you have a term life insurance policy to cover you if you die so that your house will be paid off. Your wife and children will be taken care of for the rest of their lives, or at least for a long time until, you know, they can do something to provide for themselves. Here's what Ramsey has to say about that in his book, Dave Ramsey's Complete Guide to Money. You never want to use an insurance plan as an investment. Insurance is for insurance. It costs you money because you're transferring risk. Keep your investments separate, and you'll always come out ahead. Now, this is only true if you actually save and invest the money you would have paid into your whole life policy. So in my example, if term was 25 and the whole life is 1,000, if you actually take that 975 and invest it in mutual funds, you're going to come out way ahead. If you are an adult and you buy the $25 life insurance policy and you blow the $975 on fun and whatever you're spending your money on, and you don't save any of it, then you're not going to be better off. You're not going to be better off at all. So this is kind of a bit of strange advice, but if you are undisciplined and you'll just blow the money, you may as well get a whole life policy, and then at least you'll have something saved instead of nothing. So for people who are horrible with money, bad investments are actually a good idea. If that makes sense. If you're horrible with money, buy the whole life policy. At least you'll have some cash value by the time you die. And your family will have something to bury you with. I mean, if that's your two choices, okay. You know, if you're horrible with money, have the IRS take out an extra $1,000 a month out of your paycheck and give them an interest-free loan until you do your taxes, and then you get a huge refund at the end of the year. If that's the only possible way you can save money and you have no discipline whatsoever, we'll do it that way. But it's not a good idea to give the government an interest-free loan until the end of the year. Just be disciplined and save the money yourself. So get a term life insurance policy, which will cover you until your early to mid-60s. Term life insurance, like I said, is dirt cheap compared to whole life insurance. Dave Ramsey recommends getting a term life policy for 10 to 12 times your annual income. So if you made $100,000 per year, you should have a life, according to Ramsey anyway, and this is standard advice, If you make $100,000 a year, you should have a term life policy of between $1 million and $1.2 million, right? If you made $50,000 a year, it'd be $500,000 or so, $500,000 or $600,000, whatever. That should be able to take care of your family for, you know, quite some time. Now, here's the other person that needs life insurance, and that is stay-at-home mothers. Stay-at-home mothers should have a term life policy also, which will cover the cost of childcare and possible maid services in the event she dies. People often forget about this, but if you have a stay-at-home wife and you've got four kids and she's staying at home, yes, she has no job, she has no income, but guess what? What happens if she dies? You got a giant bill sending these kids to daycare or whatever to be taken care of, and all the other stuff that she does that you have to replace and whatever. So stay-at-home mothers should have a term life policy also. And I think, personally, now probably a lot of people think I'm crazy, but I don't really care. I think somebody that has a stay-at-home wife ought to have a term life policy on her too. I know I do. I just took out a $500,000 policy on my wife. She's a stay-at-home wife. She doesn't have any income. You're thinking, well, that's stupid. Why in the world would you take out a life insurance policy on her? Well, because paying somebody to do the grocery shopping and the cooking and the cleaning and all that stuff would be very expensive. And I don't have time to do that. I'm maxed out as it is. I don't have time to go grocery shopping and cooking and cleaning and all that kind of stuff, especially the cooking part. That's a ton of work. So I took out a life insurance policy on my wife. And if she dies, then I will pay somebody to do the grocery shopping, to cook, to deliver me meals three times a week, and I'd have enough, you know, get meals delivered on Monday. I'd have enough for Monday and Tuesday, meal delivered on Wednesday, right, Wednesday and Thursday, so on. I'm not kidding you. That's exactly what I would do. I don't have time to do otherwise, or the inclination, or the energy. And I'd pay somebody to clean the house, too, probably. That's not as big of a deal, but I'd probably pay somebody to do that too. Now, you may think that I'm crazy or that I'm pathetic for this. But you know what? Ask me if I care. Ask me if I care. It costs $25 a month for $500,000 of coverage. It's worth $25 a month to me that if, God forbid, something happened to my dear wife, that I wouldn't have to grocery shop and cook meals for the rest of my life and put me through a life of misery. So, I don't know, maybe you, like I said, you probably think I'm crazy, but whatever, I don't care. So, you say, well, just remarry. Do you realize that I found the one woman out of the 3.5 billion out there that's actually interested in somebody like me? So the chances of that ever happening again are like slim to none. So yeah, it's worth the $25 a month for me. That certainly wouldn't replace the companionship. It wouldn't replace the confidant. It wouldn't replace the encouragement. It wouldn't replace any of the really important stuff, but it would at least replace the drudgery and make life a little bit easier. Now, getting back to having this term life policy, by the time you're 60, your house should have been paid off a long time ago. Your kids are probably grown, chances are, unless you got off to a very late start. And you should have no debt. And you should have a large amount of money saved for retirement. So at that point, if you die after age 60, you should be what is called self-insured, meaning that your wife should be able to live off your savings for the rest of her life. So life insurance is unnecessary when you're that age. Or should be, anyway. Now, another type of insurance that you should have is health insurance. Even if you never go to the doctor, right? I mean, I avoid the doctor like the plague. I never go to a doctor unless I absolutely have to. But I still have Christian Healthcare Ministries because stuff happens. One major illness or injury could ruin you financially if you don't have health insurance or if you don't have something better like Christian Healthcare Ministries. High deductible, high out-of-pocket maximum policies will save you money, right? They are cheaper. Even they are very expensive these days, but they're cheaper than these Cadillac plans, which probably just about nobody has anymore. But as I mentioned, health cost sharing ministries are much cheaper than health insurance. I have Christian Healthcare Ministries. There are other ones out there as well. I've had this for over a decade. And when it comes to medical care, I'm a cash payer. Okay, so for most things, when I go to the doctor, I pay cash. When I go to the urgent care, I pay cash. When I go to the pharmacy, I pay cash, right? I pay cash for everything. Except now, I do get free telemedicine for doctors and urgent care visits online, you know, whatever that's worth. I haven't used it yet, but I suppose maybe in some circumstances it could be worth something. But that's free, which is nice. But if I end up going to the hospital for something, then CHM, Christian Healthcare Ministries, reimburses me for the cost after my personal responsibility amount of $3,000 has been paid. So with health cost sharing ministries, it's not a deductible. It's a personal responsibility limit because it's not insurance. But think about it as a $3,000 deductible or $3,000 out-of-pocket max. So the most I'm going to pay is $3,000 in a year, no matter what happens. That's it. And then my wife would be the same thing. If something happened to her, most would be $3,000 in a year. This plan cost me $180 per month per person, so $360 for the two of us. Go out there and try to find a $3,000 deductible insurance plan for you and your wife for $360 a month. You're going to pay three times, four times, five times, who knows how much more. You're going to pay way, way, way more for that. And this is for unlimited coverage. I just recently increased that. It used to be up to $125,000 per illness. And I thought, what the heck? So I threw in the extra $30 a month or whatever it was. And that takes it up to unlimited. So if I had some horrible health catastrophe where I got some terrible rare cancer or whatever, had to have all kinds of treatment for a long time, and it ran up $1 million bill, it's all covered. So I recommend it. And if you want to sign up, let me know. I'll give you my referral link and I get a free month. This is not why I'm telling you about it, but I don't mind getting $360 for free. So if you do sign up, go ahead and do that. Help your pastor out. Another insurance you should have is home insurance. Like I said, a fire, a tornado, or another natural disaster could leave you in serious financial distress without health insurance. And you should not be without it. And that's another insurance that's going way up. It's getting very, very expensive. It's unbelievable. For some reason, health insurance in Missouri is very expensive. I don't know if it's because we're in Tornado Alley or what, but compared to a lot of other states, home insurance is quite expensive here, from what I've found anyway. And then the fourth insurance that you should have is car insurance. At least liability. Liability insurance is a must, and it's legally required. And for goodness sakes, don't go with the state minimums of $25,000. You may as well have nothing. You get into a major car accident and you're going to be on the hook for a huge money because that 25 grand doesn't cover hardly anything. Dave Ramsey recommends at least $500,000 in liability insurance to protect yourself from bankruptcy in the event that you are at fault in a major accident. I used to have a lot lower maximums there for liability because I was trying to save money. Until I realized, well, it's probably not the best idea. So I increased mine up to 500, 300,000 per vehicle or per person, 500,000 per accident. Cost you a little bit more, but you know, it's probably worth it not to go bankrupt if something happens. You know, for instance, you're running from the cops, you end up in the roof of the Clay Ray Veterans place or something, you know, that'll run up a big bill, you know, so. Probably a good idea to have some liability insurance. Or, like the other poor guy, you have a seizure and end up doing the same thing and nosediving into the pavement and then cartwheeling into the Clay Ray Veterans building again. So. Now, depending on the age and the value of your car, collision and comprehensive coverage could be a good thing to have. If you're driving an old clunker, in my opinion, it doesn't make any sense to have collision and comprehensive. What's the point? You're going to pay more over the course of several years than the car's worth. And if your car is old and getting older, if it's not worth much, then you should do the math to see if having full coverage on it is worth it or not. And that's what I did recently, and I recently dropped the comprehensive and collision on my car because I just don't think it's worth it. Car's worth about $3,000 or so, and the comprehensive and collision would have cost me, I think it was, over the course of 4 years, it would have been about $1,500. I think I had a $500 deductible. I was thinking about raising that to $1,000, but so you figure if the car's worth $3,000, even with a $500 deductible, if you did get into almost any kind of wreck, they're going to total it. Chances are they might not even give you the whole $3,000 minus the $500 deductible. So now you're down at best, you're getting $2,500. And if it lasts for 4 more years, I just paid $1,500 out in premiums. What's the point? That, to me, it doesn't make any sense. Just when a car gets down to a certain value, I just say, get rid of it. That's what I've done over the years. Get rid of the comp and collision. Because here's the thing. If I get into a minor accident, and by a minor accident, I mean the car's still drivable, okay? So, like, I don't really care what it looks like. I wouldn't turn it in if the car's still drivable, if it's an older car like mine. I just either drive it looking like it is, or I'm just going to sell it to a junkyard and buy another one. One or two. I'm not going to turn it in. Why would I? I'm not going to have a ding on my insurance over some claim that they're probably just going to total this old car anyway. And if it was a major accident where the thing was totaled, like I said, the money that I end up getting back probably wouldn't be hardly worth it. So I just dropped it. And hopefully we don't get into an accident in the next few years and it lasts for a little bit while longer. But if not, I'll just buy another one. That's why you should have a car fund. You get the money saved up in your car fund. If you have a car fund and you have enough in there to replace your car, and your car's older and it's costing you a bunch on insurance, drop the insurance, and then you can buy a car if you need to. That's where I'm at on the matter anyway. I think it makes sense. But that's a personal decision for each of you to make on your own. And then also, high deductible policies will save you money. And if you have a car fund with plenty of money in it, and you should, then paying the deductible, if something happens, should be no big deal. So instead of having a $100 deductible on your car and paying hundreds of dollars every 6 months for that, you could have a $1,000 deductible on it and save those hundreds of dollars every 6 months, and you have a car fund that you can pay that $1,000 deductible out of if you happen to get into an accident, right? So you can save your money, you save yourself that money, you can save yourself money that way also. So just, you know, do the math to see if raising your deductible makes sense. Now, here are some other types of insurance that you should consider. I don't think these are must-haves. The first four, I believe, are must-haves. And, of course, I don't have scripture saying thou shalt have health insurance, car insurance, home insurance, and life insurance. I don't have scripture for that. So if you don't want to get them, you know, whatever. You take the risk and you will suffer the consequences if things don't go your way. But these other ones are just considerations anyway. Long-term disability insurance. This coverage can often be purchased through one's employer at a reasonable rate. And it might be a good idea for the provider of a family to have just in case. If something happens to you and you get out of work for 6 months or a year or something like that, if you are especially the sole breadwinner in the family, and that would put you in financial distress, that'd be something to consider. Another thing to consider is long-term care insurance for nursing homes. I think everybody knows nursing homes are very expensive. But this is interesting. When I was doing a little bit of research on this, I found that Missouri is the second cheapest state in the U.S. for nursing home care. I thought that was very interesting. I don't know why that is, but second cheapest in the nation. It costs $5,262 a month, this is on average, for semi-private care, and $5,931 per month for private care. This is about 57% of the average cost in the United States. So on average, other places cost almost twice as much as Missouri does. So if you're ever going to get old and decrepit and have to go into a nursing home, it's a good idea to move to Missouri to do so. That's what I'm learning here anyway. Nevertheless, it would still cost Missouri residents approximately $63,000 per year to live in a nursing home. Just do the math. Multiply those monthly numbers out. $63,000 per year to live in a nursing home. In a few years of that, or a few months for a lot of people, would completely wipe out most people's savings, leaving them with nothing for their spouses and no inheritance for their children. Now, don't get mad at nursing homes. Everybody hates nursing homes. I don't think I've ever met a single person who likes nursing homes. Everybody hates nursing homes. They're just evil. They just bleed you dry. They take all your money. You don't have any money to leave to your family or anything. They just suck everything out of you. They're not like philanthropic organizations, right? I mean, they're doing a service and being paid for it. If you give somebody housing and all of their meals and medical care and other care and entertainment and whatever else, I mean, do you think it's unreasonable to charge $5,000 a month when it would cost you $2,000 a month to rent a house, and it would cost you $500 a month for groceries, and it cost you who knows how much if you had to pay somebody to come over and help you do things and give you your medicine and whatever? I mean, yeah, it's going to cost money, of course. I mean, don't get mad at nursing homes. They're just providing a service, that's all. They're providing a service that families either will not or cannot provide themselves. That's a lot of work to take care of somebody. Some people can't, some people won't. And that's what nursing homes are there for. So, and just, to, I mean, people think like, it's just wrong. They'll just take everything and then they'll take your house after you're gone. They're providing you a service. Why wouldn't they make you sell your house to pay for it? Well, you expect them to just do it for free? Would you do it for free? Would you take in a neighbor and have him live with you and provide his housing and his food and all of his medical care and everything? Would you do it for free? Probably not. Why would you expect the nursing home to do that? So this is what long-term care insurance is for. It isn't extremely expensive if you get it by age 60. This is from an article called "What is the Cost of Long-Term Care Insurance?" from Forbes. It says the average cost of long-term care insurance is $1,200 a month for a 60-year-old man for $165,000 coverage, according to the American Association for Long-Term Care Insurance, AALCI. Now you think, well, $165,000, that's not going to cover me a whole lot. That's only like 2.5 years or a little more. But you know what? The average person only lives, I think it's about that long or less in a nursing home. Most people, when they go to a nursing home, and I forget the exact statistic, but I think it's less than 2 years, and I think the average is only a few months, right? Most people don't last very long when they go to a nursing home. And that it's not because nursing homes are like poisoned or something. It's because you pretty much wait until you cannot live at home by yourself, which means you're about dead, and then you move to the nursing home, and you got a few months left, and then you die, right? That's what happens. So, you know, chances are $165,000 is going to cover you. The average long-term care insurance for a 60-year-old woman is $1,960 for the same coverage. Now, I find that interesting. I don't know why this is. I didn't look into it. That costs a lot more for women than men. And I don't know. Apparently, women are more likely to go into nursing homes, maybe. Or, I don't know. I don't know why. Or maybe they're more likely to live longer after they get into a nursing home than men. There must be some reason like that for it. Married couples can buy a more affordable joint policy. For instance, married couples who are 60 years old pay $2,550 annually on average for a joint policy with $165,000 coverage, but that comes with a combined coverage limit rather than two separate limits. So essentially, if you go together, instead of paying, you know, over $3,000 per month, like almost $3,200 a month, if you had separate policies, you'd pay $2,500 a month. So you'd save a big chunk of money, but it's only good for one of you to go into the home. So basically what you're doing is you're paying less, and chances are both of you aren't going to end up in the home and one of you is. And if you had policies on both of you, you'd have paid more, and more than likely only one of you would have gone in anyway. So that's the gamble there that you're taking. Now, here's the thing, though. This is for you younger people. If you manage your money during your lifetime, like you have learned to do in this series, you will likely have enough money to hire somebody to live with you and provide you with in-home 24-hour care instead of going into a nursing home. In-home care will likely cost no more than living in a nursing home. Think about it. It costs $63,000 to be in a nursing home. Do you think you could find some 20-year-old single lady and pay her $60,000 to live with you and to take care of you in your house? Probably. You think that there might be some 20-something-year-olds out there that would like to make, I don't know, twice as much as she could make at Walmart by just taking care of some old person, assuming it wasn't like horrible, you know, like where you had to do things that she just physically couldn't do. So anyway, that's an option. You know, you could just hire somebody to do in-home care and it would cost you no more. But that's if you've done the money thing right, like your whole life, and then you got a lot laid up and you have options and you don't have to go to a nursing home. All right, well, I didn't get to the part on being rich, so next Sunday, Lord willing, we'll pick it up there. And the Bible actually has a lot to say about being rich, and it has a lot to say about being poor. So we're going to look at being rich for a little while. We're going to look at being poor and the blessings and the curses of both of those things, because both of those things come with their pluses and minuses. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention this morning.